Hello, and welcome to the Sheldrake Vernon Dialogues with myself, Mark Vernon, and Rupert Sheldrake. Hi there, Rupert.
Hi, Mark.
We get together and quite spontaneously decide on something to talk about, which we've been reading through, heard about, been in other discussions, to try and develop the conversation around a particular subject. Our thoughts, we hope, will prompt your thoughts, and so create a sense of engagement with the various things that engage us. And today we thought we would talk about artificial intelligence. It's clearly very widespread in the culture. What is it? What isn't it? What can it do? What can't it do? What does it say about our humanity and so on? But Rupert, there's a very particular hook to our conversation today because of the recent use of artificial intelligence in the field of protein folding. And this is an area that you have studied for decades, in fact. So I wonder whether you could say something about that and, you know, what this advance really represents. Help us to get a sort of feel for what artificial intelligence can really do and achieve.
Yes. The problem of protein folding has been a central problem in molecular biology for decades. And the reason it's a problem is that proteins consist of a string of amino acids, you know, 100 or more, quite commonly, and each amino acid can rotate, and then they fold up and they form complex three-dimensional structures. But with that number of amino acids, each being able to rotate freely, the number of possible structures is vast. I mean, it's in trillions, even for an average-sized protein. And the original models of protein folding tried to work from first principles. You work out all the possible conformations the protein can take. Then you measure the energy of those, and then you find the lowest energy, the minimum energy, and you assume the protein sort of roll down like a ball rolling down a slope into a kind of well. This minimum energy structure should then be the actual structure. The problem is that there are so many possible structures, there are hundreds of minimum energy structures. This is called the multiple minimum problem. And this has dogged this entire field of research ever since the 1970s. And I myself got interested because I think that protein folding, which happens much quicker than it ought to, involves morphic fields and morphic resonance. I think it involves habits and a kind of memory and formative influences over and above random search. Random search for the minimum energy structure, where even if it could find a single minimum, has been calculated to take longer than the age of the universe for a simple molecule like ribonuclease. In fact, ribonuclease folds up in a test tube within 2 minutes. So clearly something's going on. So all attempts to predict it have failed. It's been an enormous challenge. And every 2 years there's a contest called the Critical Assessment of Structure Prediction for Proteins. And this contest involves various theoretical groups and protein groups around the world being given the primary sequence of a protein, the string of amino acids, the sequence they're in, and asked to predict how it will fold up. And most of these predictions over the years have been wildly inaccurate. Successful ones were ones where they could predict one of the 200 or so possible structures. That was called a success. Now, what Google has done, using artificial intelligence as part of their deep mind thing, well, their first really impressive result was 2 years ago in the CASP, the Critical Assessment of Structure Prediction contest. They won it 2 years ago with reasonably successful predictions. This year, they've won hands down and undoubtedly have achieved something that no one else has achieved. This has led to a surge in the share price of Google, to financial advisors advising people to buy Alphabet stocks. You know, it's worth billions and billions and billions of dollars. So what have they actually achieved? Well, what they haven't done is worked out how proteins fold from first principles. They haven't sort of worked it out in accordance with the laws of physics and chemistry. What they've done is applied a kind of artificial intelligence pattern recognition system. So they've taken thousands of proteins where the structures are known, and then they take the unknown one and compare it with the known ones and find the nearest match, and use the existing knowledge to predict what the unknown one will be. And this has turned out to be a very successful approach. What it doesn't do is give a deep insight into the way proteins fold up. It doesn't give a deep understanding of the nature of nature, of how proteins fold, or whether or not there are habits and memories involved, as I think there are. It doesn't shed any light on that. It's simply a way of recognizing recurrent patterns. So that's something that artificial intelligence is very good at. These are important triumphs of artificial intelligence. So the question is this really intelligence in a normal sense of the word? Or is it just enormous computing power, which is able to process huge amounts of data and have a memory of huge amounts of data? So we call it artificial intelligence, but this is both a triumph of artificial intelligence and I think also reveals its limitations.
Yeah, well, this is what interests me as well. And in the previous announcements that DeepMind particularly made around playing games like Go and then prior to that chess, you immediately get this further conversation as to whether the computer's really playing the game or whether it's just running many iterations of possible outcomes. And I've heard people say that whilst the Go success was an advance on the chess success, you can still debate whether it's really playing the game, because as far as I understand it, the artificial intelligence was using more powerful predictive probabilistic techniques in order to seemingly use intuition, but it wasn't really intuition in the way that a human player of Go might use it. And then, of course, you've got the sort of even more fundamental question as to what it means to play a game, to be immersed in the world of a game, to be enjoying it. And so to be, as it were, listening in to the dynamics of the game with intelligence in this rich sense, rather than the computer that just generates lots of outcomes and, as it were, doesn't play anything. It's were, as it were, playing the game, but through the computer, you might even say. So it's very interesting that you picked that up in this particular case. So just in relation to your interest about morphogenetic fields, because that's interesting in itself, this advance doesn't tell you anything directly about that, about whether they're involved in protein folding.
No, it doesn't tell anything about the actual nature of the protein folding itself. It does show that certain patterns or habits are recurrent. And it shows that in the course of evolution, proteins follow sort of fairly predictable patterns of evolution. And you can learn a lot by comparing similar ones. You know, it's a bit like if you are studying the evolution of fish and you're studying a particular family of fish or insects or plants or whatever, you get to know the various kinds within that family. And when another one comes along, a new species comes along, you can see how it fits in that general pattern. It doesn't tell us that whether ordinary physics and chemistry alone can explain this. The failure of 50 years of attempts to predict it on the basis of ordinary physics and chemistry rather suggests that it doesn't explain it. That's why I think morphic resonance must be playing a part in this. Morphogenetic fields organizing the folding protein, restricting all the possibilities to a very limited number. How morphic resonance works is through creating habits in fields, and those habits restrict possibilities. Out of millions of possible forms, the field shapes and channels the development of the protein as it folds up in one particular way, instead of all the others. It restricts possibilities. But this Google prediction is fairly neutral as to how proteins actually fold up.
That's really interesting. Because the other element that gets me is the way that these advances are sold, particularly sold to the general public, and your comment there about how it's very good for the stock price, I think must play into this. That, so for example, the newspaper that I read that reported this advance with protein folding, the headline was Google Solves the Mystery of Life, which clearly is a sort of massive inflation, good for the stock price. But it worries me because I think one of the things that happens insidiously with artificial intelligence advances, without denying the advances at all, is that we kind of lose our imagination as to what, in this case, life might be, or as we're talking about more generally, what intelligence might be. And so my interest in this area is working on different kinds of intelligence, and in particular, trying to work out whether there can be such a thing as spiritual intelligence, which many wisdom traditions, spiritual traditions, seem to imply there is, that there's a way of being in the world that requires a certain kind of perception, say, of the world, and that is very, very different from artificial intelligence. But my worry is that we kind of lose the imagination to have different kinds of intelligence. And then, of course, you get the sneering comes in, and the mocking of notions of spiritual intelligence and so on, which sort of starts to police the area as if artificial intelligence is the only way to go. I mean, just to give a bit more of a sense of what the differences might be, I feel like artificial intelligence treats the world as problems to be solved, decisions to be made, kind of formula to be followed through. Whereas you might say that, put a middle ground would be emotional intelligence. And that would see the world much more as relationships to be understood, experiences to be undergone and interpreted, enfolded into one's own life, but sort of focusing on experience, say, rather than problems. And then I think spiritual intelligence would do a different thing. Again, it's much more interested in the quality of being itself. What's it like to actually exist in the world? Not to just to be aware of experience, but to have awareness itself. And how, when you focus on awareness itself, that opens up different dimensions of reality when you get more into the quality of awareness. You know, so spiritual intelligence would come in when you develop a meditative practice that's more than just about the therapeutic gains you might get, being able to negotiate emotional ups and downs better. But when you start to realize something about the nature of thought itself, and so the way that things arise and fall, and how there seems to be a steady presence, which in the tradition might be called pure consciousness, that lies behind that. Spiritual intelligence can become aware of that aspect of reality, you know, which is miles away from artificial intelligence, for all that artificial intelligence might bring. But I think we need the spiritual intelligence because ultimately we have that as part of our makeup, part of our being. And if you cut off or sneer at that quality of being in the world, then you start to reduce the sense of what it is to be human, and there may be all sorts of knock-on effects of that. Does that make some sense?
Yes, that makes total sense. Emotional intelligence is less controversial, I suppose, than spiritual intelligence. And it's obvious that emotional intelligence is important in normal life. It's also obvious that the model of the mind that late 20th century cognitive psychology put forward was that the brain is a computer, basically a kind of digital computer processing algorithms, and the mind is the software that runs the hardware of the brain. That familiar image, seeing the brain as essentially computational, left emotion out completely. So when Antonio Damasio came along with his book Descartes' Error, and as a psychologist argued that emotion influences the way people think and react, this was hailed as a breakthrough within psychology, because previously the previous models were entirely non-emotional. They were just like computer data processing. Well, for most normal people, it's not an enormous breakthrough or discovery that emotion influences reactions or the way we think or respond. I mean, it's blindingly obvious. And so it's clear that model of intelligence and of minds had left out just even normal everyday emotions, let alone spiritual insights and spiritual intelligence. And I think one of the driving forces for artificial intelligence, you remember 20 or 30 years ago, we were always reading about fifth generation computers. The Japanese were investing, were they going to overtake the West and that sort of thing, which were going to be kind of super brains that would take over the world and render us more or less redundant. I think this was part of the materialist project. The materialist project says that nature is made of unconscious matter and essentially working like machines. We're machines, our brains are machines. However, some people argued we are not machines because we're intelligent. They say, well, just wait a few years and artificial intelligence will prove that machines can not only do what we do, but do it better. Therefore, making machines that would prove that we're machines. A very curious kind of argument that, you know, to go to enormous lengths to prove we're unconscious machines, but we're so smart, we can actually make machines that are as intelligent or more intelligent than us. It's a very weird, convoluted argument, which was very much part of the kind of atheist materialist worldview. Now, the limitations of artificial intelligence, I think, have become much clearer to most people. And these triumphs are really there, as you say, but it obviously leaves out an enormous amount as a theory of intelligence, because it's clearly just one kind of processing or computation that these things can do. Well, maybe several different kinds that can be done on computers, but they certainly don't include emotional intelligence, and certainly not spiritual intelligence, which goes to the very root of consciousness itself. And of course, these computers are not usually considered to be conscious. I don't think they're conscious. I think they're just machines. They obviously are machines. It leaves untouched the whole question of consciousness, creativity, and the nature of the foundations of consciousness.
And I think that's been a change, actually, even within the artificial intelligence world, that generally speaking, people don't expect artificial intelligence to replicate human intelligence. They now talk about it as becoming an intelligence that has its own qualities. And so people will talk about general artificial intelligence that is more applicable across wider and wider domains of life, hoping for that. I was involved in a really fascinating discussion the other day as well about how an artificial intelligence, in a way, would be able to monitor all that's going on within itself, and so would be completely transparent to itself. You know, it could watch, as it were, all the tickings over in its subcircuitry. Whereas for us human beings, we're not self-transparent. There's very, you know, substantial parts of ourselves that we have to work quite hard to become more and more conscious of. And whilst in the first pass that seems like a disadvantage, this argument went that actually being able to live in a world where things aren't transparent to you is a crucial part of discovering more and more and more about the world, because you get interested in this edge of what you see and what you don't see. It fosters desire in order, you know, to know more. And that this feels like very much part of the spiritual quest, in fact. To put it another way, you might say that the negative approach to understanding reality is as important as the positive. You know, so saying in negative theology what God is not. You know, we don't know what God is, but God is certainly not mortal. We don't know what God is, but he's certainly not visible. So you talk about God being immortal and invisible. And this becomes an advantage given that reality is multidimensional. It's not just, as it were, on a surface where everything in principle is transparent to it, but requires different kinds of engagement, different kinds of consciousness in order to engage more deeply with reality. So this was another argument about why human intelligence needs this spiritual intelligence in order to engage fully with reality in a way that, in principle at least, an artificial intelligence that understood itself completely, is it where it might never think to look beyond itself. And whereas for us, that happens all day, every day. You know, then people started saying, "Will you program into the artificial intelligence ways of trying to engage with other dimensions of reality that it otherwise wouldn't even, you know, have a sense of them being there?" But then the argument went on a stage further, and we noted how spiritual intelligence often develops through periods of breakdown. In, you know, the technical jargon is that it's tropological intelligence, so that something has to turn, has to evolve, has to be undergone. And, you know, this is quite a common experience that, you know, you live your life, then something happens, say a death that you experience, you can't cope with it for a while, you become overwhelmed by the experience, but then you move to a new stage where you realize that death and life go together, and that actually by almost leaning into a difficult experience, more of life shows up, in fact, something you just never had anticipated before. But you feel you get in touch, say, with a sense of life that holds all things together, whether they're living or dead, whether they're alive now or have been alive previously. And certainly in therapy, you know, this has become something that's really important to be able to do in order to be able to integrate all sorts of factors into the present moment. So, you know, this idea of how spiritual intelligence requires experiences that, again, the point is that you can't sort of imitate them. You can be told about them, but, you know, it's a bit like death. If you can be told about death, that death happens, but it's not until you actually undergo the experience of someone dying that you really know what death is like and know how to relate to it. And that's becomes a growing point. There's something about it. Maybe a simpler analogy would be like riding a bike, that you could, as it were, tell a computer how to ride a bike, but it would need to actually get on the bike like we do, have a sort of body in order to be able to do it. Now, in that case, you might imagine that a computer could be given a body and so learn to ride a bike. But actually, the embodiment issue is interesting in itself, because I think, too, there was an old argument that in principle, you could replicate human intelligence and then download it onto any system that was capable of running the programs. Whereas I think now it's much more accepted that the kind of body you're in does affect the kind of intelligence that you have and are capable of. So there's a sense of these things opening up, actually. I think it's actually called 4E in the intelligence world, which includes embodiment. But I still want to try and articulate what this further spiritual intelligence might be, because it's almost like by seeing it, we see the richness of it. And don't just reduce everything to the domain of problem solving, which artificial intelligence clearly is so good at.
Yes. A lot of our own mental activity is sort of physiological. I mean, we're not usually conscious of the beating of our hearts or the lungs, the breathing rate, although we can influence, they are influenced by our state of mind. If we're frightened, the heart beats faster and we can control our breathing, as in pranayama and other breathing exercises. But also a lot of our, what cognitive psychologists would call computational activity, is unconscious. The cerebellum, for example, seems to be a largely unconscious part of the brain concerned with organizing movements, like in riding a bicycle. So a vast amount of our actual brain activity is dealing with unconscious functions that we may have had to learn them in the first place, like riding a bicycle. But once we've learned, these things become habits, and habits are traditionally seen as unconscious. I think they are unconscious usually, unless we make them conscious through a special effort. So a large part of our mental life is habitual and largely unconscious. Not necessarily unintelligent, because it's got there by intelligence, it's subject to natural selection. So spiritual intelligence, presumably, is about the conscious part of our mental life and the way we consciously adapt to changes, like, for example, adapting, as you said, to a death, or for that matter, to a near-death experience. Many people have their lives changed by a near-death experience, which has happened as a result of an accident or a heart attack, not something they've planned or anticipated necessarily, and not something they've achieved through spiritual practices. It's just something that happens, usually as an accident. And yet, it can give people a conscious experience which is life-transforming. And psychedelic therapy is a way of doing something rather similar, but in a more controlled way, because people can often have life-transforming experiences through psychedelic experiences. But those wouldn't be transforming unless there was an intelligence that could assimilate and incorporate these into a larger picture and a larger awareness of consciousness, not just within ourselves, but beyond ourselves. I mean, the consciousness underlying the universe, pervading nature, and of course, the consciousness in other people and in other animals. So in that sense, spiritual intelligence would be very much concerned with the realm of consciousness and the interpretation of things within larger frames of meaning, which is not something that would happen from within an enclosed system like the Google DeepMind protein structure prediction. That's looking at lots of protein structures, lots of amino acid sequences, comparing and contrasting them and coming up with predictions. But it's not asking deeper questions about the nature of life or even about how proteins fold.
Yeah, I think one way you can sort of track this almost is by looking at key words and seeing how the word means something quite different in different realms. So words like simplicity or reduction or essence, they mean quite different things, whether you're talking about the world of artificial intelligence or spiritual intelligence. You know, so in artificial intelligence, you make something simpler by breaking it down into its constituent parts, and then you can manipulate the parts in order to produce some kind of outcome. But in spiritual intelligence, simplicity is much more about trying to understand the core of something and the kind of steady presence that's almost like the bedrock or the ground from which diversity, multiplicity, and so on might then spring. So in spiritual intelligence, when you're trying to simplify something, you're not breaking it down into many parts. You're looking for the thing that is steady at its core of the essence. Actually, the word reduction works quite well in this analysis as well, because reductionism in modern scientific parlance, again, means breaking down, reducing things to constituent parts, basic units like atoms. Whereas in spiritual intelligence, reductionism, it's actually a memory of the word that's still, strangely enough, remembered in cooking. Because if you make a reduction in cooking, you, as it were, take off all the kind of extraneous liquids, say, until you get to the core flavor that actually was the kind of essence of the whole substance to start with. And spiritual intelligence has reductive processes, I think, but it's in that sense. You know, so in a meditative practice, you get to know the ups and downs of the everyday and start to see that through that maelstrom often, there is a steadier sense or awareness of life that's kind of like a reduction of life. It's an intensification of life. It may be felt and known as quite quiet or maybe as shining, but nonetheless, it's that kind of awareness of being that you not so much seek, because again, you can't quite seek it. It's almost like you have to remove parts of life in order for this more profound quality of consciousness to start to shine and to burn through, so that then you can align yourself with that ground of being more and more. So anyway, but the point is, you know, words like simplicity, reduction, essence, I often think to myself, now watch out, how is this word actually being used and what's getting lost as much as what's being revealed by the way that it's used? Maybe that's a point to begin to draw things to a close. I think we've been talking for about half an hour. Mm. It's a complicated area. I mean, it's great to have actually the tangible example of the protein folding, and you explain what has been done in this case, but what hasn't. And that makes sense, because it's like you're saying, what hasn't really been done is deepen the understanding of what's going on actually in protein folding, for all the predictive power clearly has taken a substantial leap forward.
Very good, Mark. Yes. And thanks so much for taking us from these very practical methods of predicting protein folding and their effect on Alphabet stock market price and that sort of thing, to this vision of spiritual intelligence, which is clearly dealing with a quite different realm and is a completely different way of thinking about intelligence, but one which makes complete sense, at least to me. So we'll have to leave it there, I think, but there's still plenty of things to discuss in our forthcoming discussions.
I look forward to that. Thank you.